10-1 over, and a visit with Cookie and Franklin this Saturday night at supper, the 29th of May, 1971. 10-1 over. 10-1 over. And a visit with Cookie this Saturday night at supper, the 29th of May, 1971. They're putting the tractor back together. Got the piston sleeves in. They're putting it back together. 10-1 over. This visit with Cookie and Franklin this Saturday night at supper, the 29th of May, 1971.
I think more of these beans and potatoes might do that.
There's more beans cut, could you?
I do.
You like the chili?
Mm-hmm.
Want some potatoes?
Yeah, that's why I like beans and potatoes cooked together.
You do?
Mm-hmm. That's enough right there.
Yeah?
We'll rest just a minute. I eat faster. Beans and potatoes go good together.
What do you think? And then the ham in there, too.
Aye, but that's the eye is worth going to for vegetables, and you can get cornbread, corn muffins.
Yeah.
If you like it. Of course, they've got all sorts of things, but that's what I eat in there. But now, where is it you were talking about? It's not at the little cafeteria.
Mm-hmm.
Is it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the dormitory, residence hall.
Yeah. See, each one of them's got a cafeteria in it.
Yeah.
And I know over at Graham Hall, me and Melvin, we've been going in there together. And neither one of us have any teeth and we can't eat everything. So that colored lady there makes a soup.
Yeah.
Yeah. Charges a quarter for a great big, well, a bowl of soup about like that right there. I mean, that's all you want to eat.
Yeah. You can't beat that.
No, uh-uh.
Ain't got no teeth neither.
Mm-mm.
Don't make them match.
And that's right there handy. You don't have to drive all over town.
No, you shut my tractor off, and when I'm working there, just walk inside.
Down at Wise's, that's just good clean cooking, you know, just good cooking. I think they started that. All those office people come in there.
Yeah. I wondered where they all went. I saw them walking that away.
They sell out. I've been in there when there's out of them.
Hmm. Well, they don't throw away nothing.
Been open for a long time.
By now, you take Cookie's Steakhouse up there on North Main Street, right there across from the shopping center. They've had the same cook in there. She colored, but she's a good cook. They've had her there ever since I delivered milk in Gainesville.
Is that right?
Yeah, and it's changed hands a dozen times.
Oh, really?
But they still got the same cook.
What's the name of it?
Cookie's Steakhouse.
On North Main.
On North Main.
Across from the shopping center.
Mm-hmm. That but a self-service shoe store.
Mm-hmm. Oh, in that little block.
Yeah, right in there. And they have a regular customer every day. You can go there and get a steak dinner, a country fried steak dinner for $1.25.
Yeah.
And it's fixed, by golly, with gravy. You don't get a great big steak like that. But you get a reasonable sized piece of meat and two vegetables, I think, and a salad and coffee for $1.25. That's the working man's lunch.
Sure. Yeah.
I eat there a lot when I worked at Brazington. I'd drive from Brazington all the way down there and just to eat lunch down there. And they're prompt service.
And you park over there in front of the
shopping center. You can go in there and get waited on and eat and get back to work in an hour.
Yeah.
And that's something.
Did you all stagger your getting off time at Brazington?
Uh-uh.
All got off same time?
Everybody left at one time.
Yeah. I think it helped to stagger a little bit. Say, you know, from 11 till 2 or...
That's what they did at the big store.
It is.
Everybody staggered. One person at a time. We take a break at 7 o'clock. One guy goes at 7 o'clock. One goes at 7:15. One goes at 7:15 to 7:30.
Yeah.
Well, till you be take care of the customers out front then.
Yeah. Well, of course, at Brazen, they all lay down the tools at once and let everything wait for them. But if you are some other business. You gotta keep on. What all that ring gear, Cookie? How is that going all cars?
Not all cars, no. They've got a ring gear, but not like that. A lot of them come made to the flywheel.
Yeah. And then if you buy a new one, you got to buy the whole thing.
Got to buy the whole thing. New flywheel costs around $35. That ring gear, I think, costs between $6 and $7. No, $7 and 3 cents what it costs. Tax and all.
Yeah, and the difference is not putting it on and thinking, oh no, putting it on new and not that much trouble, is it?
No.
Of course, in these old tractors, they figured a man's time wasn't very valuable. Well, he'd do it himself.
Yeah.
A whole lot of them. Well, some country mechanic could do it who didn't get anything much anyhow. That way back there, you see, that made 1950. If you had that where you could put pressure on it, sort of equal pressure all the way around there, you wouldn't have to heat it much.
Uh-uh. No, but it almost tightened back up before we left down there, hadn't Frank?
Yeah. And then when you're putting it on, if you had one of those, what do you call it, a clamp, a C-clamp.
Yeah.
You know, something like that. To sort of tighten your clamp, would that do any good?
Oh, yeah.
Now you see on this we got it on there and it bounced off.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of lost motion, wasn't it?
Yeah, all that heat I put on the first time didn't do no good. That one bounced off.
Yeah.
That was gone.
And gone. Now, how much heat will that take and still keep his temper?
As long as you don't get it yellow.
Just red.
Just red. It's like I, you know, when I got it red around there and
yeah.
told Frank to get his torch off.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I see.
But you get it yellow and the temper's done and gone then.
Done and gone.
Done and gone.
Well, now, do you have to get it red?
Yeah, in order for it to expand.
Well, now, if you press it equally around there, you see, when you put one side down on there, then you're making it hard to get the other on.
Yeah, that's right. But I didn't have nothing to press it equal.
No.
Supper was good.
Well, you don't do it but once.
Okay, fine. Thank you.
12 months.
Yeah, once. That's the second one I ever done. that's twice in 20 years.
So no use rigging up.
Any use spending $50 to rig up a deal to put one on like that?
Yeah. Well, there are old sea clamps that do it.
He's going back to work. He's going to work on his truck now.
Oh, I see.
He going to work between spells on his truck, see?
Yeah.
Well,
what is it? He's gone in debt now. He's in, on the gas.
Yeah. He went there. See, instead of paying for his gas, he went when I know he had the money.
When he had the money?
Yeah. Well, he buys it on credit.
Yeah.
Well, he goes and spends his money going to see this girl, taking her to the show and so forth.
Yeah.
Okay. Now he ain't got no money, and the fellas are wanting his money for his gas.
Yeah. And he can't get no more.
No. And he got too much pride about him to come and ask me for it.
Yeah. He'd be hacked. He'd feel hacked if he hadn't come.
Yeah, I'd hurt him if he had to come to Daddy and ask him for money. Oh, I'd hurt him. Hey, don't fix me none. I got more here than I can eat.
Okay.
You can give a little bit after I pay.
Well, I hope you feel
fine. I'm telling you, that credit, cookie. When they get that credit, a good case of that credit, that'll squeeze them. They're all running fast on that,
aren't they? Told me down a while ago, he said, I'm going to pay this fella up, and I ain't never going to buy no more down there.
He can just
Now, Cookie, this mishap on those pistons in the sleeves, now that's something that happens all the time, ain't it?
It happens every day.
You had the number.
Yes, sir.
Everything down there. 8N.
8N, that's right.
He gets you one for the model before that.
That's right, the 9N, which was a smaller engine. Now, whether he goofed up, whether the warehouse goofed up, but somebody goofed up.
And you couldn't tell by looking on the outside thing, or you didn't look.
No. Well, I couldn't have told anyway, because that number didn't correspond with the... I got no way of tracing it back to the parts number, see?
Yeah.
And there's so very little tolerance there. I mean, it's hard to see with the naked eye. You take 40 thousandths, it's hard to see with the naked eye.
Oh, you mean that's all it was?
That's all, 40 thousandths.
But when it comes to putting it in, you could see it.
It just fall in.
Damn.
It just fall in.
Well, I'm a damn. what the man, what Doug say?
He said, you have to get different sleeves. He said, these too small. He said, them for a 9-in.
He knew right off.
He knew right off. He said, they got to say they're not going to get them.
Good news, wasn't it?
Yes, sir. That's music to my ears.
That's music. Now, you put up with that all morning. The man was coming over from Bronson to this little shop, machine shop up there, to put him in for you. And if he had got there, wouldn't that have been nice?
It would. He must have knew the dang things wouldn't fit before he come. He must have knew it.
He must have had a bird must have told him. All morning. He was coming over from Bronson. So they didn't have them out at the Santa Fe factory there in Gainesville.
No.
And they didn't offer to get them for you.
No. They didn't offer to tell me where I could get them. In the flywheel, either one.
Is that right? And all your friends out there gone?
They're gone. They're all gone. They run them all off. So I just won't go back out there no more, period. I just won't go.
That has been more money, and they lose money. Those people who take over that thing, they tell me they lose money.
They do?
Big money. $50,000. But you know the man that had that last time I was out there, he was a crippled fellow. And he lived out there, I know where he lived, I went out there. And he offered to sell me an old mower that was been sitting out in the weeds for no telling how long. Rusted out, and I even went out there to see it. So I don't have much. He lost money out there, and I don't have much sympathy. I don't. When they have said you something, Cookie, when they have said you something, I don't know. It seems to me like
knowing it ain't no good.
Just knowing it ain't any good. Even offering to say you something, knowing it ain't any good. Well, you buy it not.
Well, I'm like Frank. That was good.
Well, now this fella Doug at
Swift.
The Ford place down there. You might do some business with him. First and last. If he'll stay there long enough. Now, you didn't. Did you talk to the salesman?
Yeah.
Does he know anything? He's a young fellow. He don't have to know anything. You know what you want.
He don't know that. When he tried to tell me if that 8-in Ford tractor would handle that big mower that we were standing there looking at,
yes.
You know darn well he don't know nothing.
Is that what he said? Did he tell you that?
I don't want to buy one right now.
Well, where do you suppose they got him? Is he Mr. Swift's boy?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't even know what his name is. He gave me his card and I stuck it right in my pocket.
Yeah.
Tom Fouch. Fouche.
Yeah.
Tom Fouch.
Well, he might know something. But they've got right as much equipment out there, more than I've seen out there.
Oh, yeah. Well, see, they're getting ready to supply the university now with new equipment. On a rental basis.
Down there?
Down there.
Oh, they are?
They sure are. That's what they told me today.
Golly.
That big tractor that I'm running out there now has got 250 some hours on it.
Yeah.
They're going to pick it up.
Yeah.
They're going to take it back in and sell it as a new tractor.
Sell it as a new tractor.
As a new tractor. And I have worked the living fool out of it.
Is that right? Well, I didn't know they'd do that.
Yes, sir. They're reconditioning it. I mean, they'll go through it. If there's anything wrong with it, they'll fix it.
Yeah.
Then they'll sell it and give the customer a new tractor and warranty on it.
Oh, yes, yes. But they don't charge a full price.
No, they can rake off some. I mean,
Well, let me tell you, this fella, I told you about that. This fella was going to sell me one that they had was taking back, getting back, you know,
mm-hmm.
on the same basis for the university. And he said they did it all by computers, and I might get the best tractor they had, and the computer figured way down low. And they told me about one that was coming in, and they knew it was going to be low. And when I went down there, $2,000. When I went down there, it was $2,800.
Uh-huh.
So I just quit fooling with them on tractors.
But I think I'll get that wagon for less money. I'm going to go through Doug.
Oh.
I'm going to horse trade with him.
What do you got to horse trade with?
I'm going to talk to him. I ain't going to trade him nothing, but I'm just going to Jew him down. Just like you do when you're horse trading.
Well, you probably got something he'd want.
I have, but I don't want to trade it. That Ford truck out there. No, I don't want to let that go.
Well, you gotta have some.
Well, I better go see if that thing's cooled off and tightened up.
Okay.
That was channel one over around 300, and Cookie got right up and went out to work on the tractor. That was Saturday, the 29th of May, 1979, channel one over around 300. Saturday night at supper, the 29th of May, 1971. Now, Lorraine Bassett is out here with Jim and Suzanne. And we've got this student strike from last year to talk about. Around 3:10, channel one over, on Cookie's tape. This Sunday afternoon, the 30th of May, 1971, Lorraine Bassetta, channel one over. Around 300, 310, on the Cookie tape, this Sunday afternoon, 30th of May, 1971.
Where you
going
to sit? Over
here? Doesn't matter. I come to the old lady. She didn't go with that.
Go with Suzanne?
I was with you at the time.
Oh,
Brian.
Yeah,
That lasts a long time, a drum of that spray.
How do you like the smell?
I didn't notice it too bad. Yeah, I really didn't. I was just having fun riding on the tractor. I never been on a tractor before.
You don't notice it until you get back and get it on your clothes.
And so you're trying to eat something and it all smells like the spray.
You know what you need to do. Unless I do something like this, I get pretty tense. I don't know why, but I get involved in things. And even if I don't, even if I just listen to the news, you know, it's hard on me just to listen to the evening news.
It's hard on me to survive these days.
Do you ever notice that, Cookie? Just listen to the radio. Those news, you hear some things you don't want to hear.
Yes.
So, unless I get to, I don't know, put out a little spray or something like that, I get pretty tense or something like that.
To release.
How did you ever get into that strike last year?
I don't know. I was always so apathetic towards, you know, politics, what was going on in the country. I was always so involved with just being a young girl, you know, all the things young girls do. And I started to grow up last year, really, I guess. And I thought it was important to participate in something greater than my own little world, you know, expand, get out of my own little world. And this was a starting point for me. And I was influenced by people around me also who were in it. And I got involved, you know.
Didn't take long, did it?
No, not at all. Very, very quickly and very intensely. All. Didn't take long.
How long was you in it? Before your big activity over there? Months?
How long was I in the strike?
Well, into the interest and in all that. 6 months?
I don't know if I understand the question right. How long was I in the whole political scene, you mean? Let's see. Yeah, I guess it must have been a happy year.
Well, that's a long time for a tour, isn't it? 6 months.
Yeah. Well, because when I was in New York, it was still going. You know, when I went to New York, I told you in the paper, you know. I went to New York after I was in the infirmary. Yeah, I wrote it down. I was in New York staying with my brother and Sheila. And then there was also striking going on in New York at the same time, so I was there for 2 months, marching down the street. But I was marching, but I wasn't really in with it then because I had already gone through a very, very bad emotional time. I was just sort of drifting along with the people, but I wasn't.
That was after this?
Yes, this was after the thing here. New York is even worse. I mean, you go to New York, you're overwhelmed because there's millions of people and they're all going down the street and they're all, and it's really unbelievable there, you know.
And you've got freeloaders there. You've got people that'll turn handsprings, huh? That'll move, huh?
Yeah.
Active.
Yeah, oh yeah, active. I mean, they're not playing around over there. I mean, this was a little fairy tale compared to when you get to New York and you see what goes on.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was more dangerous too because they had, like, I was walking down the street one day and I was sort of like on the sidewalk because I didn't want to get right in the middle of the crowd. And they have policemen that ride horseback, and they carry big clubs, and they don't like people with long hair, and they don't like people shouting peace and end the war either. And they walk around, they ride on those horses, and they just as soon knock you over as look at you, you know. And they're there to supervise things, but they're very angry, and everyone's very angry. So just a big angry process. Yeah.
You mean just ordinary little march down the street is angry?
Well. In just a little ordinary mall. Well, the kids are chanting. They're chanting different things. And the people on horseback, the police, don't like the kids for what they represent, but they don't really know what they represent.
Yeah.
They don't know. They just don't like them, you know. And but you've got a lot of young people that are very active in New York, much more so than here, you know. You really find it. It's very intense there.
That chanting does something to you?
It inspires you. It arouses all sorts of different emotions. That's what I was telling you. You don't think with your head sometimes because it's all these overpowering, explosive emotions, you know. And everybody's chanting the same thing at once, and it's just an emergence of the entire crowd, you know. And then you become angry when some intruder with some dumb club comes along.
Yeah.
They don't understand.
Yeah. Call themselves the law.
Call themselves the law. Justice, you know, justice, like the Tulls got justice.
Yeah.
You remember that sort of justice.
That's
legality.
That's what I always get, too. What sort of tanning did you do?
Well, we did some what they called obscene chanting.
That's always gets the headline.
It was just, well, I won't repeat it. It wasn't so bad. It was just chanting. And then we did, we shouted, you know, we were shouting peace chants. And, Some of them were angrier than others, you know, like 1, 2, 3, 4, we don't want your fucking war, you know, and the police really didn't like that, and that was loud, and you could hear that all over, and or else it was, so we'd sing, there's a John Lennon song with Yoko Ono, what was that song they used to sing, oh, Give Peace a Chance, all we are saying is give peace a chance, and we'd all sing it. And that was sort of pretty. And one night I remember, you know Father Gannon that works at the university? You've heard of him, haven't you? Well, this was in Gainesville. He led us to O'Connell's house, and we sang that song, and we all had candles, and there was a whole procession of us. There was about 5,000 people that night. I swear to God, it just gives me goosebumps. There was just people all over the streets, and everybody linked arms with the person next to them. They didn't know them, but it didn't matter. And like there was that emergence again, you know, it didn't matter who the next person was. All of a sudden, he was your brother somehow. And we all had candles, and it was called the Candlelight Procession. And we marched all the way to Dr., you know, O'Connell's house, and we sat there. He's got, you know, beautiful piece of land. We all sat and sang, and then we bowed our heads and we prayed. And even if you didn't believe, well, I mean, you just sort of prayed to whatever you believed for in or something. There was a lot of beautiful moments in it, you know.
Was that before or after the strike?
This was during the strike.
During the strike?
During the strike.
Yeah.
During the strike, there were a lot of, we had the candlelight procession during the strike. Then we had the burning of Nixon in front of Tiger Hall. Just to let out our aggressions, we all were in front of Tigard Hall one night, and you know, they made a dummy, and then they put President Nixon's face on it, a big face, and we put him up against a pole, and we all sat around and we lit it, put it on fire, and then we all really got excited about that. It was just a and then all this these fire trucks were coming down the street. They thought some horrible thing was going on. We freaked the police out. They just... We were just burning the president.
You know, what do you mean, freaked the police out?
Well, I mean, they didn't know what was going on, you know, the firemen and the police and, they were a little baffled when they got to the scene and saw what was happening, you know. So we...
Too simple for them.
What's going on with these hippie kids, God?
They wanted you to be burned down.
They wanted to burn us at the stake.
Yeah.
And I, you know, the night we went, well, the day we took over Walker, we went to Walker Auditorium. Well, they renamed it now, you know. They renamed it because we took it over. And after that, it had another name. And we all went in there. I was so scared that day. Because, well, I was scared because we were taking over an auditorium that we thought we had the right to go in there and sit. It was going to be a meeting place, you know. It's a large auditorium. And we wanted to have a meeting place where the strikers could meet, and everybody pulled in money, and we ate there, and if you wanted to come in and sleep, or we wanted to have that as a meeting place. So we took it over, or what they quote, we took it over. And I was one of the first ones in there, and I was with a friend of mine, and we were holding hands, and we walked in there, and I just looked around, and I thought, oh my God, I'm scared, because we were doing something that we weren't, you know, according to the law, supposed to be doing, although we felt it was our property as well as theirs. You know, we went to school there, and we thought we had a just cause, so we went in there, and I was really scared, and because they threatened us that if we did go in there, the police were going to come and clobber us over the heads, you know. And we were taking a chance, you know, a risk. And I'd never done anything like that before. And so we sat down, and all of a sudden, everybody was just jammed. And there were a lot of professors, like McGill gets involved, you know, Professor McGill. A lot of people from the philosophy department that backed us up, they came in there and gave speeches. And there was a lot of so-called radicals in there giving speeches. And then we'd have some so-called conservatives that would come in and say, why don't you get out of here? You know, what are you doing? And everybody, boo, 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 go away. That's where all the confusion was, though, you know, because there'd be so many different people giving different speeches, and we'd all react. Like somebody would yell, you know, revolution, and that, great, revolution. And then somebody else would yell, no, peace, oh, great, peace, you know. And, you know, it just got all so emotional, you know. You just sort of didn't know what to do, what to go along with. You just wanted an answer. And O'Connell came. Oh, he's a funny man. You know, he came in there and he said that y'all, we had to be out of there by 7 o'clock or the police were coming in for sure. And man, if we weren't out of there by 7 o'clock, there was going to be tear gas. And we were, you know, and I was really scared then. But I didn't move. I sat there because they kept saying, now you sit here, you know, the people that were our leaders, you know, you stay here. And I thought, no, I got to stay here. But I wanted to go. I was so scared. And but I stayed. I don't know how. And we were asking O'Connell questions, none of which he would answer. He never gives you a straight answer. He just goes around everything. And then when he's through, he always says, thank you. What do you mean, thank you? So he threatened us. And finally, we had to leave because the police did come. And we all just sort of linked arms. And the professors, the people from the faculty who were for the strikers, it was amazing what they did. They were between us and the police. They actually all got together and sort of just tried to protect us as we were going out. And there was, you know, it was a whole load of people. And I can just remember squeezing Barbara's hand, you know, thinking, oh. And then there were some fraternity people outside that didn't like us either, and they wanted to beat us all up, you know. There were a few fights. It was sort of scary, you know, the whole thing. Strange. You want me to read it?
But now, when did it start backfiring on you?
You mean when did I end up in the infirmary?
Yeah.
Well, when the strike was all of a sudden over. You know, it had gone on for a couple of weeks, and then there was a weekend or so. And then classes resumed, I remember. The weekend, that's what happened. The week after the weekend, that Monday,
yeah. There
was no more strike.
Yeah.
It just was not going to be, it just dissipated. It just, I don't know what happened. That's why I got so freaked out. I just don't know what happened. And I explained it in the paper, you know, what came over me. I couldn't understand. I had no understanding.
This fell apart.
Yeah, I fell apart. I literally did. I was so exhausted emotionally, physically, that I did get sick. I had a virus, and then emotionally, I believed in nothing. Nothing at all. Nothing was real. And if it was real, it didn't matter.
Yeah.
Green
little thing. Just let me, I kind of forget how to do it.
Last spring, I had to experience a portion of myself dying before I could awaken to that part of my real self which lie buried beneath a tremendous restlessness and confusion. The sun was fiercely beating down on my face, but I marveled at the colorful images my eyes were receiving from its rays. I felt comfortable and secure that beautiful spring day as I lay beside a pool of clear, refreshing water. My mind wandered and fantasized. Suddenly, someone was excitedly raving about an uprising at the university. The students were rebelling against the immorality of the Vietnam War. "We are going to strike," the intruder called out. Curiosity overcame me. I was sitting inside my apartment later that day, and I decided to go on campus to witness the situation I had heard about by the pool. When I arrived at the scene, I was overcome by a large crowd and forceful speakers who were citing the injustices of the government, university, and military. I listened intently, at once becoming a part of the issue at hand. I became furious, just as the others in the group were, at all these branches of society. The student rally lasted 3 or 4 hours. I was hungry but determined to stay with the protesters and support the cause. It was not important to eat or sleep or go to school. Who cared anymore about those so-called necessities of life? I found a greater issue calling me. For days, I participated in many activities of the strike committee. I marched, collected money, spoke to different people, attended meetings, and always remained where the strikers were. A few nights were spent out in front of Tigard Hall, sleeping on the ground, waking the next morning feeling exhausted but eager. I truly believe that a nationwide strike among the universities would help bring about an end to the war. The world was going to be a better place, a free and just habitat for all. My idealism rose to such heights that I was completely blinded to the reality which lay before me. My thoughts were positive then, why there wasn't any chance that I could have been on the losing side. One sunny day, the strike was over. I saw people returning to their classes. To my astonishment, I saw radicals going back to school. Nothing had changed. The world was still in a mess. The Vietnam War continued. This was madness, I insisted. How can one devote so much effort and time to a valid cause and come out feeling empty and exploited? I asked myself these questions endlessly. There just was no conceivable way I could return to school. Besides having missed taking midterms, I was thoroughly disgusted with this prison called school. I would be nothing more than a traitor if I returned to my normal way of life, when there was so little accomplished during my days as a protester. Actually, I was still rebelling, but not just over the war this time. I rebelled against parents, religion, school, and many other facets of life. There was no consolation anywhere. I was lost and helpless. My next endeavor was to try to talk with a good friend in order to find answers and direction, but she did not have answers, only compassion and a sorrowful feeling for my bewildered condition. I walked away from Diane with tears in my eyes and love for her, but she couldn't help me. No one could do that. The street was almost bare and unreal. Anxiety overcame me. The trees were dreamlike and the cars appeared purposeless and absurd. People were mere shadows or perhaps figments of my imagination. Somehow I made it to Dr. Busby's office. He opened the door and smiled pleasantly. I didn't have a cheerful greeting in return. My glum and tired look made him inquire as to what was the matter with me. I started to explain by first warning him that he was not real and nothing else was either, but I was scared. He listened to me quietly and cautiously, slowly trying to help me perceive my situation more clearly. I understood little, but needed to be calmed down. Finally, we decided that I should enter the infirmary for a rest because I was emotionally and physically exhausted. Staring out upon the outside scenery from my room in the infirmary, I viewed everything in a mechanical sense. That is, I felt somehow secretly special, because I no longer belonged to that cold, apathetic world. the condition of alienation, of being asleep, of being unconscious, of being out of one's mind, is the condition of the normal man. R.D. Lang, psychiatrist, stated this in a very profound book. I recalled the words and reflected upon them. I did not want to be normal anymore. Maybe I was abnormal, but that was good because it suggested that I was different than those machines outside. After a week had passed by, I decided to drop out of school and go to New York to visit my brother and sister-in-law, two people who meant more to me than just about anything in life. My mother had come to Gainesville to visit me and was confused and upset to hear of my inner conflict and outward antagonism. She was beautiful and gentle, like always, but at this particular time there were no words or ideas she could render. I wanted to be free of everything and everyone who represented authority. While in New York, I read many books pertaining to philosophy and psychology. I discovered me in a lot of those books, the person undergoing anguish because of society's pressures and rigid standards. I couldn't live and I couldn't die. My existence was intangible, and I frantically searched for knowledge and truth. Gradually, I quelled my soul. I reasoned and sought out new ideas and experiences. My previous actions and lifestyle were weighed, and I began to gain perspective of my motives and decisions which led me to emerge into the person I was becoming. Now I was more conscious of my needs, desires, fears, and expectations. My behavior became more rational with time, and I moderated my being. After some months of staying out of school, I thought it feasible to return so that I might secure the necessary education in order to teach children. Motivation returned. Here I am back in the one place I swore I'd never step foot in again. The surroundings are the same, but I am not. My sense of awakening was accompanied by a sense of realness which differentiates between illusion and concreteness. I am still an idealist in some ways, but I'm not a fool. Many times I do not understand what is happening to me, but I keep working with myself, trying not to lose track of my own personal limits as a human being. Hostility does not rule my life anymore, but that is not an indication of indifference to the problems and sufferings of the world. I am determined to seek out more knowledge and positive action. I never want to become idle, but I do not want to be overcome. A happy medium does exist. It just takes a little time to reach that point.
Now, Ryan, a lot of that, you didn't feel hostility too much at that time when you all were involved in the strike and leading up to it.
Well, I didn't feel, no, you see, because I didn't feel the hostility because I felt that what we were going to do was going to work.
Yes.
The hostility came when it didn't work.
Oh.
And I was very hostile and very angry, especially when I was in the infirmary. Boy, I was really mad. And there were moments during the strike when I was mad too, you know, when I was mad at O'Connell or I was, you know, mad at something like that.
But
I was angry.
Yes, but while everything was moving along, you were...
Oh, I was happy.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, I was content. You see, that's where I said in here I was blinded. I was so idealistic that I was, you know. And there was romance in the strike, too. You know, you fell in love because people were so kind and so together. You know, there was... that sort of a thing.
Well, there was a whole lot of things then that happened.
Yeah, it was one of the biggest events of my life, you know. To a lot of people, it was just, well, it was a strike and it was over. See, I could look at a strike now like that, perhaps like they did then, but then I didn't look at it that way because
yeah.
I didn't know anything.
But all of it was pretty emotional.
Yes. For me, I would say yes.
Even when you were moving along and experiencing things, you were still right emotional.
Yeah, more so than anything else it was.
Well, now, still some of those experiences are clearing your mind.
Now, yes, they are now. But they weren't then, you know.
Say, like what you said about the police coming to clear out Walker.
Yeah.
And the members of the faculty standing in between.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's clear.
Huh?
Yes, that's clear.
And then that picture of the burning President Nixon.
Yeah.
What do you see in that? Mostly the... Well, a lot of things.
Well, what did I see in it then or now?
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 I mean, what do you recapture when you look at it? A lot of things.
Well, it's mixed. I can recapture the amusement of the scene, and also it was symbolic. You know how symbols are. You know how they play such a great, you know, they're in everything, symbols. It was just a release, you know, like going out spraying your... It was a release to see him burn.
No, I don't know that. I don't believe I know that. You mean really?
Yeah.
No, I don't know.
No, I don't want to stick pins in somebody I didn't like. But I see how she can feel.
It's just like, you know, sometimes if you're mad at somebody or something, if you just picture in your head that you're, or sometimes when I get real tense, now this might sound crazy, but let's say you're really upset. If you just picture in your head that you've got a hatchet in your hand, you can just go through the house and just tear up everything with this hatchet, you know, and just bang it up against the wall as many times as you want, you know, or just swing it around until it just makes you exhausted. If you just picture all this in your head, it releases some of the tension. So you actually won't take the hatchet and go and, you know.
Well, I'm not so sure.
Well, that's worked for me, you know.
Yeah.
And same thing sort of like this. Just, we couldn't really do it, but we fantasized that we did it. And it was symbolic of you know, doing it.
And
getting
it was
rid
a
of
big,
him.
Big group.
Yeah, it was a big group.
And somebody had talked about it? No.
Had talked about doing it?
As you fantasized about it. You just did that yourself.
Well, yeah, but you got the vibrations that everybody felt the same way because they were going, yeah, right on, you know, yeah, like, and all it was a dummy, and everybody clapped when it was going on.
Yeah.
Yeah, for hours you couldn't get down 13th Street.
Right. Locked out the whole goddamn place.
I know, I was right there.
For hours you couldn't get out of
right.
He was right up the corner there. you know, right there, George off the University, that little base station?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's right, he was.
I saw a lot of events there.
I'll bet you did.
Why do you
say that? I saw a lot of their events, but I was,
yeah.
I mean, I just passed them off. I didn't really take in or snuff in to remember what all went on.
Nobody else did either. That's why I strike it.
Well, how would you? Unless you got into it, you'd have to go on with them and see what went on. You couldn't just stood there
right.
And walk.
That's right. I couldn't take the interest in it because I had my business.
That's right. Everybody had their business. That's what everybody's got right now. They've got their business to tend to.
Yeah.
They can't take time out, you know.
I couldn't walk off and lock my door.
No.
I mean,
no, they couldn't.
Down the street.
But, you know, we walked down to the courthouse one day, too. You know, all the way from someplace to the courthouse, and here are all these business people hanging out their windows, just looking at us like we were nuts. They couldn't take time out. You know, we kept saying, "Come on, come on! This is your country too. Get off your asses and get out here." What? What kind of thing is that? We're too busy typing and things, you know.
Yeah.
We got to keep this production going on. And yeah. We went to the courthouse, and they told us we were trespassing to get off their ground. But we didn't get off. We just sat there. There were so many of us, they couldn't do anything. And they wouldn't let you in the post office to buy stamps. We went to the post office, too, because all we were barefooted hippies, and we couldn't come in and buy their stamps.
They didn't want it.
They didn't want any of us in there.
Your business.
They didn't want our business. They wanted the businessman's business.
Yeah. Now, who were those fellas afterwards? And where was it? Don't you know you said, one of them said, yes, he had to get back and take a test.
Well, now see, this is now some people. I mean, this is in any group or any organization or whatever. You're going to have people that are actually they're totally involved in what they're doing. They believe in the cause. I mean, just like William, you know, Kunstler. I mean, he's really into what he's doing. He puts his life on the line. You know, his whole being is into it. Well, now Bruce was considered a radical. You know, he got up and he talked a lot. And he went through the rooms yelling, "Strike! Get out of your seats and strike!" And a lot of us really were into this sincerely. And I think Bruce was also. But he had a midterm during the strike to go take. Now, you weren't supposed to, if you're going to strike, you don't go to your classes and you don't take midterms, because otherwise the strike is not a strike. You do it all the way or you don't do it at all. Or, I don't know, I think that's the way it goes. That's the way it went for me. And, because otherwise you wouldn't have much of a strike. And he was in my class. And I said, "Well, I guess we're missing the midterm, you know, naturally. Well, screw the midterm." And he said, "Oh, but Lorraine, I've got to go take it." "What do you mean you've got to go take it?" I said, "You can't." I said, "What if somebody sees you taking it and they were in one of those rooms that you were yelling strike in?" I said, "What if you can't do that, you know?" And he said, "I have to do that, Lorraine. I've got to get out of school." I mean, and I thought, well, contradiction, hypocrisy, here it is. You know, that's what I thought at the time is what it was, you know. And he went and took the test and I didn't. So naturally, I'm going to fail the course if I'm not going to take the test. Was the midterm, and I didn't take it. And now, when I look back, I see that Bruce did as much as he could, his own personal limits allowed him to do, which I did not see then. I think he overdid it in some ways. I think he was a bit hypocritical, but we're all, you know, we're not infallible, let's face it, and we all have those hypocrisies within us, those inconsistencies. But he was interested in what he was doing. He did get himself involved, maybe from peer group pressure or whatever, I don't know. Maybe for appearances, maybe because in part he was truly interested in what he was doing. But he couldn't say, "No, I can't take the test." He couldn't do that because it would have been caused him too much anxiety not to have taken it. School also was another important aspect of his life, so he had to make a decision. So perhaps I should have respected it, but at the time there was no way. I couldn't see that.
And that was a sort of a blow too.
Yes. Oh, that was a big blow. See, that was another symbol, you know, of like, well, what's going on? I don't understand, you know. If you're in it, you're in it. What are you going over to the other side for, you know?
I don't have that little Jesus coin thing. I don't think I have.
I do. I can put my hands on it. This is it. Yeah, I'll put my hands on it.
I actually went over around 980. And this is a continuation of Lorraine Bassetta reporting on her experience in the strike of last spring, 1969. or 70 rather. This is Channel 1 over. Lorraine Bassetta. Suzanne's here. Cookie's listening in. Sitting in. Jim. This Sunday afternoon, the 30th of May 1971, Channel 1 over, around 9:80, 9:90. The end of Channel 1 over, really. And a continuation of the report of Lorraine Bassetta on her experience in the student strike last spring of 70.